Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Biography. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today we're talking with Linda Haywood about her new book, Jinga of Angola, Africa's Warrior Queen. Linda, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Well, I teach at Boston University. I've been teaching here since 2003. Before that, I taught for 19 years at Howard University, and I got my PhD from Columbia University and my undergraduate degree from Boston University. And I'm a historian of Africa and Africans in the Americas.
What led you to choose Jinga as a topic?
Well, I had been teaching Central African history way back at Howard University, and she was one of the individuals who the students were always fascinated when I brought her up that lecture. And then when I came to Boston University, I decided to do a new course on women in Africa. And that's how I decided that I was very interested in women per se. And then I had co-authored a book with John Thornton on Central Africans, Atlantic Creoles, and the foundation of the Americas, looking at the first group of Africans coming to the English and Dutch-speaking Americas. And we had touched on Jinga in that book. And since I had done a lot more research than I had done when I was teaching in the early years, I decided that she needs to have a book. So I then went ahead and did the research to write a biography.
I have to say, given her prominence and given the amount of documentary material there is about her, it really is surprising that yours is one of the first books about her, because she had such a fascinating life, and as there's a lot of good sources about it.
Well, these sources are, you know, in 17th century, the two first biographies that was on Jinga by Gaeta, the missionaries who knew her and were in her court in the last phase of her life. But these were not translated into English, so that and you did have elements of her life surfacing in a lot of different ways, even in literature in the late 18th and 19th century. But no one had done, and you did have some works on Jinga, not biographies per se, scholarly works written in Portuguese, but really not a biography. And my biography is the first really historical biography in English. And that's why I think it's very important.
You've been referring to the Portuguese, and they play a very large role in Jinga's life. And I was wondering if you could start us off by explaining a bit about their presence in West Central Africa, and also the political environment in West Central Africa in the late 16th and early 17th centuries.
Well, the Portuguese actually first arrived in West Central Africa in the 1480s. They actually went to a northern kingdom, the Kingdom of Congo. In 1491, the king of that state converted to Christianity and did a lot to sort of domesticate Catholicism, you know, in his kingdom. His son, Afonso, was very instrumental in fact, making sure that his nobles and all the population actually converted to Christianity. And they considered themselves a Christian kingdom, wanted to be identified in Europe as a Christian kingdom. And they then went to south of the Kingdom of Congo to another state, which was Ndongo. And the rulers of Ndongo, they were called they had a title called the Angolas, N-G-O-L-A-S. And they had been persuaded because of the success of the religious and political relations that the kings of Congo had with the Portuguese, to in fact try to get in direct touch with the Portuguese. So they had attempted this from 1560, a first Portuguese delegation came. 1575, the Portuguese came back and really decided to conquer that area and spread Christianity, as well as, search for minerals. They would think that there was gold and other treasures, as the Europeans had found, at least the Spanish, in the Americas. But the big thing came out of the slave trade that the Portuguese developed in the region, and that led to large millions of Africans from the 1500s to 1860s being exported from that region, not only to Portuguese area of Brazil, but also to the Spanish, as well as to the English and Dutch and French regions of the Americas.
You describe the role that the slave trade plays in not just the economy of the time, but also the politics and the diplomacy. I was wondering, though, if you could take us back for a moment and address two things. First of all, why was converting to Christianity so important? And second, what benefits did kings like those in the Congo have of establishing this contact with the Portuguese? Basically, why did these African rulers reach out to establish that contact, given that the Portuguese were, you know, taking so many people out of the region?
Well, first of all, we have to remember that the domestic politics, regional politics, expansion of states played a crucial role in the calculation of these African rulers. That's the first thing. So Portuguese arriving in the Congo River Basin, in the 1480s was something that brought another player into the picture. The Kingdom of Congo was expanding. So they didn't set out to just sell slaves to the Portuguese. They set out to look for certainly cultural and diplomatic and other types of relations that would allow them to follow a domestic agenda. This was the same reason why the kings or rulers of Ndongo reached out to the Portuguese. So domestic politics important. One of the things also that one should keep in mind was that Europeans, as they went into the Americas, they were developing colonies. So their calculation was to make those colonies, if the colonies did not have the type of ready, minerals that could be extracted, and populations that were not accustomed to really strenuous agricultural labor. They found populations in Angola and Congo in Central Africa that were, developed, populations with, regional centers of production, goods being transported over long distances, wars leading to captives. The societies that were hierarchically, organized with people who were rulers or in the elite, people who were free peasants, people who had the status of serfs who were kept on the land but would not be removed from the land, and people who were captives and brought in to the society who were dispensable. And initially, these were the first people who were exchanged, let's say, for goods and other products that the Portuguese brought. In the case of the Kingdom of Congo, they would be exchanged for some of the religious items and missionaries who came to that area. The people in those areas had ways of calculating, exchange. So the Congo used Zimbu shells. The Angolans of Dango had units of exchange, one goat will be equivalent to some other object. They produce copper. So we know that these areas had their own systems of calculation. And the exchange of captives, these are people who were not part of your society, who were brought in as captives. They had certain status. They didn't have legal status within the community, and these people were expendable. In the case of the Portuguese and their dealings with Ndongo, their interest was capturing and the parts of Ndongo and the hold of Ndongo, in fact, then, because this was a calculation of the Iberian powers, Spain and Portugal, to bring Christianity to organize society along the lines of a feudal and exploitative, state systems that existed in Europe. And sometimes this involved exporting Portuguese citizens to these areas where you would have settlers, and then making sure that the settlers had backup to impose military and economic regime on the populations who were called the conquered populations. And in the case of Angola and Congo, the Congo took the strategy of reaching out to the Portuguese and having alliances with the Portuguese. This did not guarantee the Congo security. And in fact, some Congo kings, complained that, you are now taking our people. We did not come into this relationship for this type of, disruption of the way our system worked. In the case of the Ndongo kingdom, this was pure conquest and imposition of Portuguese rule, taking over of lands that that were under the rule of the people of Ndongo, of the rulers, the Angolas, and then exporting those people as captives, as slaves to Brazil and to Spanish America. There were also those people were all some of them were also kept on plantations that the religious orders like the Jesuit established at large, donatarios. That's land that was given to these, to some religious orders, including the Jesuit. And the Jesuits were, in fact, the military arm of conquest for the Portuguese in Angola. Or the major captains who came out with a disposition from the King of Portugal to, in fact, conquer these lands and bring them into Christianity, they set up their own plantations and slave systems and exploitative systems were set up in Angola as well.
I was wondering if you could describe just in a bit more detail Ndongo as it was when Jingo was born in 1582. Excuse me, 1582, and what her early years were like within the kingdom, and what her family was like.
Well, from what we from what Jinga and other older people who lived in her court relayed to the missionaries who came to her court in the 1850s. She was very much a precocious child, but the environment in which she was born was one where the wars that the Portuguese made against Ndongo had taken off after 1579, especially, and there was a lot of insecurity her father, grandfather, other relatives were fighting against the Portuguese, who were taking over larger areas of Ndongo, even the capital. They moved they set up forts, military forts, so that it was, I believe that Jinga grew up in an environment where resistance to the Portuguese was very much in the minds of the older relatives in her court. Her father was fighting, her brother fought against the Portuguese. She claimed that she was very much reared as in her father's image. She would be in courts with him when he was given dispensing judgment. She listened to all the traditions. She was very much trained as young men were trained, you know, as military for fighting. And she swears that she was also trained and she would in these military arts. And she would, you know, beat her brother. She was very, there was a sort of, I guess, a competition between her and her brother. And so she was a normal child, but a child who had a purpose. She really modeled her life, in my view, on the life of her father, who was fighting the Portuguese for his old reign.
And it sounds as though she was being groomed, maybe not necessarily to become queen, but definitely to be a important figure in the kingdom and a major political actor in her own right.
Well, yes, because as a member of the, her father was the Angola, so she had a certain status. Her mother also came from a certain, not the same region, but was very much you know, important. She admired her mother's family, and there were the lineages were very strong. These lineages or families intermarried, and she saw herself as carrying on a legacy. She was very much of a royalist in that sense. She knew that in her, you know, in her kingdom, there were people who were privileged like herself, and there were others who were free, you know, on the land, who remained on the land, and there were others who were captives and, you know, who were slaves and could be disposed of.
How does it that, when does she start getting involved in politics? What's her first, you know, time as a political actor in her own right?
Well, the first time we see her, there's a reference to her, you know, sometime between 1618 and 1622, we do see her, the reports about her meeting with the Portuguese governor in 1622, when she is called by, apparently she was not living with in the court. She and her brother had some estrangement, and she was away from the court, but she had her supporters from the court. And her brother called her and back to go as his representative to bargain or to on a diplomatic mission in Luanda, because the capital of Ndonga was not in what the capital of Angola is today, Luanda, but it was in the some distance into the country of Angola, and which today is Angola. So he called her back from wherever she was. We do not know how far away she was, but maybe not too far, in another region of Ndongo, and asked her to head this diplomatic mission. She took this opportunity to really place herself at the center of Ndongo politics. She was going to, you know, present the case of her brother to the Portuguese governor so that they would remove a certain fort that they had built, you know, in her, in the middle, in the capital. And she was successful in 1622. And what the evidence that we have, the details that were given, you know, collected after this event by the missionaries, was that, in fact, Jinga was successful, but not only because of her the way she carried herself, the way she bargained and argued her, with the Portuguese, and not only the missionaries, but the Portuguese chronicler, Cardenega, also mentioned Jinga as being very intelligent, very astute in her in the way she presented her case, and she was able to win over the governor and they get an agreement, even though this agreement was not, you know, followed by the Portuguese, but she did, she was successful. The Portuguese saw in her in 1622 a way of expanding Christianity into among the Ndongos, and therefore they actually asked her persuaded her to be baptized, and she remained in Luanda sometime after the political diplomatic encounter she had with the Portuguese government. She remained in Luanda and actually went through the whole process of converting to Christianity. She, at the end, she actually was baptized, and we have pictures of the book in the book of her baptism. One of the sort of iconic images of Jinga is the one that that was made of her sitting on the back of a servant / slave during the negotiations and using the back of the servant as a chair.
That religious dimension is a theme throughout your book, and you explain how important it is, not just the importance of Christianity to the Portuguese and the efforts of the missionaries to convert the population of the region to Christianity, but also the indigenous religion that existed prior to Christianity, and how that was very much intertwined with the status of the kings of Ndongo and the other kingdoms of the region, and how you describe what really is a very interesting balancing act that Jinga really conducts throughout much of her life in terms of Christianity on the one hand, and then her own people's indigenous beliefs on the other.
Yes, and that's what intrigued me, Jinga's spirituality, because she seemed to be at peace with some of the religious dimensions. For instance, the Angola was supposed to be able to make it rain and had certain spiritual dimension. He was he had a lot. His priests were able, whenever they went out to battle, he would consult his priests. So there were by the way, the Portuguese were doing the same thing. They were consulting the Jesuits. Portuguese soldiers didn't go out until they were blessed by the Jesuits. So I see spirituality in this world, and we are not thinking about the modern world. We are thinking about the pre-modern, 17th century world. People were still very much into religion. And for Jinga, it was both her religious beliefs as well as the Catholic religion that sort of allowed her to be a spiritual person, but also to use what I call religion or spirituality in a calculating way. I'm not saying that she was not a genuine convert to the Catholic faith, but she had seen the Portuguese use religion as a way to undermine Ndongo authority. So she was always suspicious of Portuguese parish priests and the Jesuits. So she did not mind the Capuchins from Rome coming directly to when she settled back down and conquered the kingdom and went and, built really attempted to build a Christian community, reconverted to Catholicism. She did not mind Catholic priests coming, but they had to come from the Vatican, from Rome, not from Portugal or from Luanda. She suspected that the Portuguese priests were coming with certain political calculations. So both Portuguese and Jinga were playing politics with religion, in my view.
She really did have an understanding of a lot of the nuances that would frankly be befitting a European ruler who had grown up in that context.
Well, yes, and this I credit this to Jinga's political kind of some inner sense she had of how politics worked. And obviously, in the Ndongo kingdom did not have the same type of organization or the same type, similar types of elite, stratification as Europe, but they had their own stratification. They had their own politics, and she was able to play that politics very well. When the Kingdom of Congo She calculated that it was good to join with the Kingdom of Congo. And the Dutch who came in to try to take and took over Luanda from 1641 to 1648, Jinga reached out to the Congo, to the Congo king, Garcia. She also reached out to the Dutch and had an alliance with the Congo and the Dutch to get the Portuguese out of Angola. And they nearly succeeded. But reinforcements from Brazil, turned the tides towards the Portuguese again. But even after that, she did not really just turn over and say, okay, you win. No, even to the end of her life, Jinga was very much thinking, how do I keep my kingdom independent of the Portuguese? I stayed with them and everybody, sort of whenever African ruler involves themselves in trading of human beings. I said, oh my gosh, how could she have done that? How could they have done this? Well, that was the only type of, exchange system that the Portuguese and Europeans demanded of Africans. So in order for her to remain part of this Atlantic world that had been established, this relationship between Angola and Brazil, was very much calculated on, Africans being transferred from Angola to build Brazil. And there's no reason why Jinga, and I knew that Jinga, my own thinking is that Jinga knew a lot of what was going on in Europe. She knew a lot of what was going on in Brazil. She knew a lot of what was going on in Angola, in the Portuguese a colony of Angola that had been sliced off from Ndongo. So when she was trying to get an ambassador to go to Rome, her own ambassador, she spoke with the Catholic priest, the Capuchin priest who were in her court and said, look, I am going to send an ambassador, but I don't want anyone to know. I don't want any of the Portuguese residents in Luanda to know what I'm going to do. I'm going to try to send him under your guidance. And we are going to say that he's going to give his condolences to the queen, who the king had died in Portugal. And then once in Portugal, then the Capuchin will get him to Rome. But the Portuguese never allow them to do her to do that because they said there's a law that no African, person could travel to Europe. So this ambassador never went. She had, given him all the things that he needed, the slaves to sell on the way, the dress. He spoke some Portuguese. She was going to have him trained in Luanda whilst he was waiting to get what we would call today the visa, to the exit visa to leave. He never went. But in the end, she said, if he cannot do it, guess what? I ask you to be my ambassador and go and kiss the feet of the Pope so that he would know that I need these missionaries. I need people to make sure that my kingdom is independent and that it would be protected in a certain sense from Portuguese aggression, because as a Christian kingdom, I could call right to the center. I could call to Rome, right? Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have to rely on the Portuguese.
I was wondering if you could take us back a bit and explain how it was that she came to the throne. And because, female rulers were not commonplace in Africa. And you do describe that the circumstances that brought her to the throne were not, usual circumstances. There was a lot of political flux taking place, and the Portuguese were intervening in order to try to obtain favored candidates that they could manipulate.
Well, yes, the Portuguese governor at the time was he was not Fernando de Souza. He had arrived in 1623, I think, or the beginning of 24, and he was very much suspicious. He had come with European ideas about ruling didn't really know about the ways in which women in the Central African region, at least in the traditions of Jenga, there were women who had played important roles in making sure their son got into power, or their relative, their male relative, or they themselves took over. He stipulated that he did not see, of all the people that you can put in power, do not let this woman, Jenga, get power, because she's a usurper. And he then states that, women were not supposed to rule in Ndongo. He didn't know the traditions of Ndongo. He was imposing his own ideas about what should happen in Ndongo. So that, when Jenga became queen in 1624, she was accused of having, poisoned her brother. There had been accusations around that the brother had, in fact, she had killed her brother's nephew, who should have been the rightful heir. And when another tradition was that when Jenga was a young woman, because she only converted when she was 40, when she was younger, her brother had made it possible for her to lose a son she had, and had also made it possible that she would not have children. There are all ways in which this was described. This is described in my book. I wouldn't go into it. But there was a tension between Jenga and her brother, and the Portuguese were able to exploit this. And the Portuguese then put in place a male from another lineage who Jenga believed was from a non-ruling lineage. She considered him, from the lineage of slaves who should not rule in Ndongo. So she put herself in a position of, in fact, reclaiming what she believed was her rightful, throne, the rightful leader of, Ndongo, ruler of Ndongo. So she was very much, had a personal, calculation to get back into ruling Ndongo and to remove what she believed to be an illegitimate ruler that the Portuguese had imposed against the people's will. And that's why Jenga was able to mobilize a lot of the population.
This struggle defines so much of her early reign. And it raised two questions for me as I was reading, which was the first one being, why was it that she had so much difficulty for so long? And at the same time, why was it that she was able to persevere for so long? Because it's one of those situations where she has these, on the one hand, these long odds, and yet at the same time, her ability to continue with this struggle is really quite remarkable.
Well, one of the reasons is that, first of all, Jenga had a core group of supporters, in Ndongo. But some of the major players in Ndongo had gone over to the Portuguese side. So because these lineages are competing for power. So if the Portuguese, they saw the Portuguese as another way of, in fact, improving their particular status within the politics of Ndongo. So there are two things going on. There's the Portuguese political climate, and then there's the Ndongo political climate. And you see some of the sobers and local rulers sometimes were persuaded by the Portuguese that they would be better off by alliance with the Portuguese. Others were of the view that Jenga was the legitimate ruler and they should follow traditions. So Jenga had actually, when she was removed from power in 1626, she actually had to mobilize a much larger group of people in an environment where you have a series of different conflicts and the Portuguese trying to maneuver and put in place people who would be anti-Jenga. there had been some, the Portuguese also had conquered some of those lands and taken under their control lands and peoples who were considered, especially the people, they were considered the serfs. They should not be sold off or removed from royal lands. And that was one of the things that that Jinga tried to do, to get back communities that she considers as part of the natural inheritance of the of her lineage. Secondly, those people who the Portuguese had put on their own lands did not consider themselves part of the Portuguese world. So a lot of them were looking for ways to, in fact, get back to Ndongo, to the capital, to the traditions. And once Jinga began to mobilize and use the tradition as well as the her fighting instincts, her mobilizing instinct, there were a lot of the Ndongo population that had been under the Portuguese control who then realigned themselves with Jinga. So she was able to do that, plus the fact she also had calculated that if the Portuguese could use the Mbangala, who were a group of what we'll call them, they are called cannibals, they're called destroyers of population, they're a group of bands of young men who went around really disrupting societies, whether this was disruption by intimidating societies with acts of cannibalism. The Portuguese has a lot of, description of all the cannibal ways and actions of these populations, yet the Portuguese used the Mbangalas. Jinga also used the Mbangalas. So when people accuse Jinga of being an Mbangala, Jinga calculated that given the political conditions and the strategic, ideas that she had, to meet the Portuguese on their own terms. The Portuguese governor, Vasconcelos, in 1819, when he made wars against the Ndongo, he actually captured 50,000 Angolans. Guess what? Some of those Angolans, the 20 and odd Negers who ended up in the first British colony in North America, in Virginia, they were from Jinga's people. They were because they came to, Virginia because the Portuguese ships, the Spanish ships that were carrying these captives across the Atlantic, were stopped by British pirates. Even though they were flying different flags, they were British pirates who took them, the treasure and the white lion, took these Africans to what is today Virginia. They'll be celebrating in 1619 the 400th anniversary of the arrival of these Africans. There were Angola, there were people of Ndongo, okay? So Jinga realized that as any military officer, it's on the field, and you have to know what the military environment, who had the power, who had the upper hand. So she became an Mbangala and carried out some of their rituals. She swore to missionaries that she never ate human flesh. This is her words, it's in the book. She also said, I have to do things that would satisfy my soldiers. So things like not letting children grow up in the Quilombo, that is a Maroon settlement, that were always on the move. She was one who made women. She had her own, she led the army. She made her own personal warriors. She trained her own personal warriors, both in Mbangala traditions and in Kimbundu traditions. That battle axe that you see, that one of the pictures I have, is Jinga with her battle axe. That battle axe was supposed to be a spiritual, only the queen, only the king, the ruler, could in fact use this battle axe and give the blessing to the people. The touch of the king, of the ruler, of Jinga, was a special touch that gave you, empowered you. These are the spiritual elements that Jinga was able to mobilize and to use strategically. But she could also use the military. She had them. She had people doing exercise. At one point, Jinga turned around and was doing a military dance in her 70s. Kavatsi said he was absolutely astounded. That she said, oh, I could have done much better when I was younger. Okay? That's it. She was an extraordinary woman, extraordinary leader, you know. That is why the Cavazzi and the Portuguese, both the Portuguese military officers and the spiritual, you know, missionaries who were in her court, they knew her. She had been fighting since 1626 against the Portuguese. Some of them had arrived in like Cadenega. He had arrived as a young man. He remained as an old man. He knew Jinga. He said she's one of the most, you know, intelligent women, strategic, military. They compare her with all of these famous women in the past, you know, in the Greek world. You know, no one could equal Jinga. You know, that's the whole thing. She is not someone who is just an ordinary person, you know.
How was it that she was able to survive? Basically, how did she come to terms with the Portuguese, and how was she able to live out her days as queen without having to without the Portuguese continually trying to destabilize her with military force?
Well, you see, she was able to get the surrounding populations to follow her. That's one. She conquered the neighboring kingdom of Matamba. She established a strategy she wanted to get her sister, Barbara, who a Christian named Barbara. She was, baptized by the Portuguese after they had killed, by the way, her other sister, who had been sending Jinga, you know, reports on all the Portuguese military strategies while she was fighting them in the 1640s. So Jinga decided that she had to stop. She was getting old. She had to remain in one place. And she had conquered Matamba, but hadn't lived there permanently. She was always moving her camp. So she decided this was the time. So in the 1650s, she began to reach out to missionaries. She sent them letters in Luanda, and they were reaching out to her, the Capuchin, not the Jesuits, the Capuchin. And they were reaching out to her. So in time, what she did was, in fact, to ally herself with the Capuchins who were in Luanda, asked them to send messages, sent letters to them to say she wanted missionaries. And she was, in fact, thinking of, you know, making peace with the Portuguese. And it was all staged. It was all Jinga knew that the Portuguese had the military edge, not in the interior where she was, but that after she was getting old, after her death, that she had to have some additional leverage. So having the missionary and religion, Catholic religion, was one where she saw as having, you know, as allowing her to remain in control of that territory, Matamba, she had captured. So at the negotiations, Jinga was able to get the eastern part of Ndongo. So she still had piece of the Ndongo kingdom, that the whole of which she thought should have been hers, and the new kingdom. This was in a signed treaty that she made with the Portuguese. And she also included in that treaty the release of her sister, so his sister could join her in Matamba and would become the next ruler. She would return to Christianity. She would baptize. She would give up all her, you know, various, you know, concubines and just marry one man. And in fact, the man that she chose was a young man who I was thinking of Macron's wife, you know, being 64 years and he's 39. Jinga was one of those women who loved youth, and she surrounded herself with young males and females. So in any case, she was able to do this because her major decision for doing this was to make sure that her kingdom of and Ndongo Matamba remain independent, and that she would pass it on to her sister.
And she doesn't just convert to Christianity herself, but she also, as you described, she tries to make her entire kingdom a Christian kingdom.
Oh, yes. She strategically, because she realized that the Portuguese might think twice if they had a strong Christian kingdom to the east. And so therefore, she made sure that all the women she declared could now give birth in Matamba, in the city and in the country, no more, you know, not giving birth, no more just roaming around. And she had all speeches about, you know, the change of life. You know, she helped build the first church, permanent church. She invested so much money. She had several churches built. She sent out Cavazzi into the surrounding areas where some of her populations who supported her and who were part of the kingdom were located, and had them have, she sent her translator, you know, who was a Congolese, by the way, you know, who knew Portuguese and who knew Kikongo and who knew Kimbundu, the languages there, and to speak to all, to call all the sobers together to say that they had to, in fact, give up the traditions and, in fact, return or baptize, you know, have their children baptized. This was a bit of Jinga's kind of a spiritual, expansion of Catholicism in the area. She had a fraternity, Nossa Senhora de Rosario, which she started in Matamba. She had women. She went to Vespers. She just, maybe because she was older, she realized the end was coming. She just seemed to have been transformed, even though I can tell you that Cavazzi, you know, believed that Jinga, in fact, stole from heaven's treasure. That's what he wrote in an unpublished poem, which I published in my book. That was she real? Had she really converted deep down? For Cavazzi, he was not too sure. He said, her body is locked up. Therefore, we can sing to a most cunning thief. A most cunning thief has stolen from the treasure of heaven. Jinga really, maybe, you know, did not give all her soul to Christianity.
It seems she really gave her soul to her people and being queen, because that always seemed to be that laser-like focus of hers.
Yes, she gave her all for her people, being their ruler, protecting them. Even though a stern ruler, she was no, you know, she, people, because she lived so long, her own people thought that she'll never die. In fact, when she passed and the news reached Luanda, now Luanda is distant from, you know, hundreds of miles from Matamba, where she died. When the news reached Luanda, the African, from Ndongo, all of them were from Ndongo, who are now living in Portuguese capital of, you know, Luanda, in 1663, right? They said that it was the missionaries who, by their own evil, had actually killed their queen, because Jinga was not supposed to die.
We've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us a bit about what you're working on now?
Well, I am working on the second book on Jinga, which would deal with how Jinga is remembered. Because even during Jinga's life, there were all these stories about Jinga appearing here, appearing there. When I went to Angola, people carried me to one of the places that Jinga had fought and said, showed me a footstep in on the rocks of Mpongo and Ndongo. These are some massive rocks that where Jinga did a lot of her fighting and escaping. And they said, here's Jinga's footstep. I interviewed several of the descendants of Jinga's followers, and Jinga way into what is still the place where people believe Jinga was buried. Not only people, the missionary, in 1957, Capuchin went to that area, and he said he believed that, you know, people, the people he spoke with, you know, believe that Jinga's body is buried there. And when I went, it's the same, you know, picture I saw, and the people told me Some Capuchins were buried in one sort of grave, but here is Jinga's grave, and they honor Jinga. They swear that, you know, they are the descendants of Jinga, the followers who followed her, and they put down all their roots along the route that Jinga took when she was escaping the Portuguese. So there was a lot of tradition, and I've collected these traditions, but it isn't just a tradition. In the written accounts, the Portuguese have written about Jinga. We have Hegel mentioning Jinga about this area that where there's a ruled by a ferocious, you know, female ruler with her furies. I would speak to that. I also would speak to Jinga's, you know, the memory of Jinga among the contemporary Africans in Angola, where Jinga is considered a mother, the mother of the nation. Then I'll go to Brazil, where we have traditions about the queen, Jinga, being elected the king of Congo, and Queen Jinga in the Congadas in Brazil. And I go to Cuba, where since 1975, Jinga has ended traditions of Palo Monte in Cuba. And guess what? In the last chapter of my book, this book on Jinga and memory, Jinga is here in North America in the 1840s. The abolitionists began writing about this queen. So I have a lot to say about Jinga and her memory in the world.
Sounds like a very interesting book.
I'm excited to continue Jinga's story.
Oh, well, Linda Haywood, I hope we can have you back to talk about that continuation when the book comes out. But until then, I hope you have a wonderful day.
Well, thank you very much for letting me just talk about Jinga. It's all exciting, and it's a story that is a world story. It's a global story. So thank you again for thinking of having me on.
Oh, you're welcome.